Live from Manchester, New Hampshire, with election coverage. I'm John Manuel, along with JJ Cooper. No, I'm sorry, we're not in New Hampshire. We're in Newark. Here at Secaucus. We're at Secaucus. We flew into Newark, getting ready to record our top 50 prospect show for MLB Network on the eve of the New Hampshire primary. The prospect show, top 50 prospect show for Baseball America, airs Friday, February 12th, 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. On MLB Network. It will re-air, actually. I have the entire schedule here, JJ, so I'll drag that out here so that people have the entire re-air schedule. It's our third year doing this Top 50 show. Very pleased to be part of it. The Top 100 drops after the show. We will build up with redone Top 10 prospects, reordered, unfrozen from their amber when they go online. Updated through here the first week of February, organization talent rankings, and then we will have, of course, the top 51 to 100 counting down on Friday afternoon, and then 1 to 50 that night on MLB Network, working along with Greg Amsinger and Bill Ripken. So we're pretty excited about that, JJ, our third time, our third different co-host. Bill Ripken's got a very high standard to live up to. And John Hart and Ron Darling the last 2 years.
That's a very high standard. And Greg Amsinger is a constant in our...
We'll just say that Greg Amsinger would never be accused by Donald Trump of being low energy. No. That would never happen.
I like working with Greg.
Yeah.
Greg
he is the Donald Trump's approved host of the Baseball America Top 50 Prospect Show. But we wanted to kick off the podcast talking about one guy who won't be, to my knowledge... on the Top 50 Prospects show, although I bet that we talk
promise,
about him.
We can't promise that it won't be, because... You know,
I bet we talk about Yulesky Gurriel.
He's technically not unblocked yet, so, or what do they call it?
Yeah, he's not eligible
yet. Cleared, so...
Right.
We can argue that, you know, with that, that... But yes, we will probably talk about him. But it's a stunning... I would say, as someone... You've followed Cuban baseball even longer than I have, but we both followed Cuban baseball for years and years and years and years.
Yes.
And... I know another way to put it is I guess it's not anyone you could say is a stunning development when someone leaves Cuba now, but if there was someone who was going to be a stunning development, it would be Yulesky Gurriel.
Yeah, and that's the guy who, you know, really, for him to leave Cuba, you had to either see Cuba's economy completely fall apart with no client state to prop it up anymore. Which is true
check.
In Venezuela.
Check.
The last.
I was going to say, they had a client state before that, yeah, I can't afford you anymore.
Their last option that was Venezuela.
Is more broke than them.
Hard to believe, but
true.
Yes. And then a combination of that, and we have to get into politics because it is part of it, an American administration that was willing to open things up. That was not going to happen under certain presidents of either stripe, of either party. Clearly, Barack Obama is that guy who did that, who opened things up.
But the other thing is
that's part of it.
But and take it a different way, though, which also is that there is, and the reason we say we should back up, the reason we say this is a shocking development, which is kind of amazing considering how many players have come from Cuba, you know, in the last, really the last 5 years. The last 5 years, it has become a torrent, a flood, call it whatever you want. But it is I'll put it this way. It's enough that I would argue it has made a significant difference in the overall talent level of the game.
In the major leagues, yeah, absolutely. No, there's no doubt. I mean, it was a trickle. But when Yulesky Gurriel first burst on the scene in Cuba, it was 2003 at the national team level. He'd been a junior national team star in 2001, 2002. I'm sure I will try to find this while we're talking. I hadn't even meant to look this up. But the infamous game where Kenny Morales pitched against Scott Kazmir in 2001, I'm pretty sure Gurriel was on that team in the 18U back then as well for Cuba.
But
this guy's been a big deal in Cuba nationally since he was 17, 16 years old. And then before that, his father, Lourdes Sr., was a significant player. Now Lourdes Jr. has also left.
And this is why this is so significant, is that if there was anyone on the Cuban national team who you would think was not going to leave until there was just the point where they said, hey, it's state sanctioned for everyone to leave. It would be the Gurriels because of their father's very close ties in the government. That was always been he's always been considered by scouts the player in Cuba who was not going to come to the States.
Yeah, the dad was a member of the party, and it just wasn't... expected that the Suns would ever leave Cuba. But certainly, as Ben Badler has written, and Ben's in the Dominican Republic today, or else he'd be on this podcast. But when you go back through the history of, you know, what Ben's written about the Gurriel brothers, it's been evolving in the last couple of years, JJ, as more and more players, as it's been a flood. It was a trick early. So, like, when Kendrick Morales, who was Gurriel's teammate on the junior national team in Cuba, when he left, made the major leagues in, what, 2006? But prior to that, 2003, 2004, even I think 2005 World Cup, I think Kendrick Morales, that World Cup was played, if memory serves, in the Netherlands. And I believe that Kendrick Morales was on that team for Cuba. If it wasn't 2005, I know he was the hero of the 2003 World Cup that was played in Cuba. Gurriel was on that team. That was their first time on the senior national team together. And at that time, Kendrick Morales was thought of as the better player because he pitched and hit.
Yeah, he was a two-way player.
He was,
not as a DH, but then he was a two-way star.
And he had more power. So here's that 2001 U.S. national team that had, we should ask our man Jeremy Sowers about that. He was on that national team. He probably faced Gurriel in the junior nationals. It's a small world. But then Gurriel really became the stalwart of the Cuban national team, really starting in 2005. And for a decade, but toward the end of that run, as other players, whether it was Jose Abreu was coming to the United States, Alexi Ramirez before him, and then the flood the last few years, Aroldis Chapman, all these other players, he was kind of the last man standing. And at least Alfredo Despaigne would go play in Mexico for a season under a crazy visa. He'd go play in Japan. Gurriel did it for half a season, JJ, and then didn't even report last year.
Did not report last year. And that was when Ben started to write.
Exactly.
Hey,
that's when Ben's antenna went up.
Wait a second here. But it has to be tough nowadays. Even the, quote, liberalization of the policy that allows a Cuban to go abroad and play in Japan or Mexico, which has gone away now. Mexico's kind of, that door has been closed largely. Or the U.S. and Canada and the Can-Am League, which unfortunately the Can-Am League, not a big paycheck there.
And that's where the Cuban national team is in such dire straits. Talent-wise, I think, and financially. That is going to be in the Can-Am
it's
League next year for,
like,
2 weeks,
for
3 weeks?
Yes.
And it's going to count as part of the season, just, you know.
But
these are things that we couldn't imagine 10, 15 years ago with Cuban
baseball.
I would
not imagine, Pedro Lazo is coming in. He's, you know, got a big match to, you know, tonight against Quebec.
The Capitales.
You know, but the thing, yes, it, really what it comes down to is we are seeing at this point, I cannot imagine... If you're in Cuba and you live and breathe Cuban Serie Nacional baseball, this has been a talent dilution unlike anything. This is basically, in many ways, I don't want to over-dramatize it, but it's watching the Negro Leagues in the mid-50s.
I think that's really fair, or early 50s, when there was no one left behind, basically, yeah. I mean, I have to imagine it's a very similar feeling in Cuba. I don't see why not. It's like the same cars, they're driving in the same era. It really is. It's the top talent gets skimmed off every year. Just when you think there isn't any more, there's more. But at some point, that well has to run dry.
But if you're the Gurriels...
And something is being lost.
If you're the Gurriels, the big thing that comes back to us is even with the liberalized policies, like, hey, you go to Japan and make some money.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not making nearly the money. Like, wait, Hector Oliveira? I'm as good as Hector Oliveira.
I'm better than
Hector Oliveira.
Right.
And Hector Oliveira just got a check for he got 60 something.
$62 million with one check for $28 million, and he can't throw.
and you have to at that point say, why am I not doing this?
I think that's really what it came down to for Gurriel. I think it's very not coincidental that as soon as Oliveira got to the United States, finally, and got paid the way he got paid, that's when Gurriel said, this can't stand. You know, that's the ultimate.
And the other part of it I would also say is that the clock is very much ticking here. Because
he's 31 years old.
Soon he'll turn 32 during the season.
Right.
And we've seen the moment that you make your intentions known, it can take months to get from there to signed and you're able to play.
And
I mean, Hector Oliveira was going through this last offseason and we're really going into 2016 saying, I know he had some, or some kickoffs.
He had more downtime, too. But still, he had downtime, but still, the more downtime, and the guy, just think about, I mean, an older player, but A-Rod was out for a year and a half. And what he did last year, no one thought he would do that. And let's face it, these guys are not as talented as Alex Rodriguez.
No.
So it's going to take... I agree that timing, the biological clock was significant in Gurriel's decision.
He's
going
to be effectively a 30... He is going to be. He's not effectively.
Yeah.
He'll be a 32-year-old rookie, which the last... Again, to make the analogies, the only kind of true analogies that really are a few Japanese league players, you know, coming over.
Kenji Jojima.
And going back, then you also had in the late 40s and the 50s, and when you had the integration of the game, and you had 32-year-old rookies. But
oldest rookies of the year, according to Wikipedia, are Sam Jethro and Kazuhiro Sasaki. Negro leaguer,
exactly.
Japanese major leaguer, exactly what you're talking about.
And so, but it is going to be interesting when it comes to Yuleski's contract, is that, okay, Yuleski
is the older brother.
Yes, Yuleski is the older brother who's played in the Can-Am League.
Correct.
But Yuleski, when it comes to his contract, in that you're not looking here, this is his payday. There's a lot of these contracts for slightly, but for younger Cubans are crafted in a way you hit free agency early, or you get paid, we're buying out some of your arbitration now,
right,
but we're paying more
like Chapman did.
Right. What you're looking at for Gurriel here is that this is the contract.
Right.
I'm not saying he won't have a second one, but by the rules of how normal free agency works, he won't be hitting a second contract with any sort of significant input.
Not likely, that's right.
He'll be 36, 37, 38, even if they give him free agency early. You're not getting a big contract that way. This is his contract.
Let's talk a little bit about him as a player. I know we've been a little scattered on him because he's just very interesting. So you have a player here who I don't even know what his closest comp is in the big leagues. I used to say Evan Longoria because there's a physical resemblance. The stance is somewhat similar as well. Gurriel's gotten a little bit bigger. I love reading Ben's scouting report from the Premier 12 where it's like scouts really notice Yuleski Gurriel running hard at the Premier 12. He was giving you average or above average times to first. He was just disinterested before. So you're talking about a guy who, even at 31, pushing 32, still by far the best player in a Cuban league, which is, again, the talent level there is so bad. How bad is it? Gurriel was hitting 494, 586, 861. These are numbers.
That's numbers you heard in 1880.
Right. This was 215 plate appearances, so it's a small sample. But it's 94. That's like better than Pat Burrell in his freshman year when the bats were nuclear. I mean, like Pat Burrell hit 484 that year with 20 home runs.
Right. And what we see now.
But this is what he's doing. He's performing at that high of a level. I mean, that's the only context I can think of that's close to that.
You have read off the strikeout stat. That's the one.
Oh, yeah. 37 walks and 2 strikeouts.
The two strikeouts to me is when it's like, okay, I understand why he's looked disinterested. I understand that.
That's better
than
Bonds.
He's bored by the league. It's like, there's just no way that someone's going to get a ball by me if I don't want them to.
I guess it's not really better than Bonds because the power is just... It's only an 861 slugging percentage. I think Barry was 869, 863, something
but that
like
that. But that is... No, that overall that year is in that, you know... It's a better overall offensive production than Bonds did. That's,
right, and he's playing third base. And by all accounts... A good third baseman, a little erratic, more errors than you would see, but an average to above average arm, average to above average agility, but this is an offensive player. This is the report we had in 2006, and I just was texting earlier in the day with a scout I know who contributed to that story 10 years ago, and he's like, from our understanding, very similar player, you know, but older, thicker, less athletic, early career, played some shortstop.
I mean, this is...
That's
it is
not
going to be
Gurriel
sad
now.
In some ways. I mean, call it sad if you want. Like, depend. But the reality of this is that we're not going to see the best of Gurriel. Best of Gurriel
is gone.
Played in Cuba.
That's right. And
played a little bored and disinterested in Cuba, to be honest.
Yeah, and especially in international competition was the same way. But so now you're looking at a player who is going to come to the United States and... If he plays in 2016, JJ, I think it's reasonable to expect He's going to be an above-average offensive player. I don't think he's Jose Abreu that impact because he's not that young. But I don't think he'd be that far off. Probably higher batting average, less power.
But here's the crazy part of this, which is depending on how this goes, because we don't know when that contract's going to be cleared. That could be very, very good for his bank account, because what it does mean is let's say that this happens in May. Or it happens in June, which is not outlandish.
No, it's not.
Considering that we're sitting here in February, you know, and the process is starting. But there are not players like this, of this talent, who become available for nothing but money.
Right.
No strings attached. You're not giving up a draft pick. You're not paying a penalty. It's just
he's beyond the bonus pools. That's right.
Cut a check. Here's your player. Those players do not become available during the season. Imagine if he's available, again, I'm being completely speculative here, but imagine if he becomes available in July. Oh yeah, by the way, you can make a trade for this guy over here and you can trade a prospect. Or you can add Goriel just for costing a lot of money.
It's really hard to believe that he would not command, in my mind, well more than what Oliveira got. He's a significantly better player. I know there might be some buyer's remorse on because of what happened with Oliveira and how that's not worked out to this point. But to me, Gurriel is a significantly better athlete and player when they were contemporaries in
and
Cuba.
And if you might make the point, should be able to contribute right away in a way that...
He doesn't have his elbow injury.
Doesn't have an elbow injury. And also, he is coming off of... He was just playing.
Right.
The rust should be significantly less here than it is often with Cuban players, who often it's been a year since they've last played.
And that's not the case.
And Gurriel has also played, I mean, again, it's a minor thing, but playing even a half year in Japan does prep him a little bit for, there's also with Cuban players, there's always an understandable, significant adjustment to a different culture, the different way the game's played. He's played in Japan. That's an adjustment to a different culture.
This is a small aside, but you didn't mention the Japan thing. That's the last Cuban, now that the Gurriels are gone, the last Cuban guy I really want to see in professional baseball is Alfredo Despaigne. Because we've heard so much about him. Like 2007, 8, 9, basically, you go back to that period of Cuban baseball where Abreu, Cespedes, I may be going back too far, but where Yoenis Cespedes, Jose Abreu, and Alfredo Despaigne every year would trade back and forth the National
insane
home
number,
run championship, which would be like close to 40 home runs in a 90-game season. And, you know, Despaigne is the last guy, and he has such sick power, and he's such a unique guy physically. What is he, 5'9", like 220 pounds?
He's an unusual it's hard to get a whole lot of physical comps.
Very short, very thick. I mean, basically, he's like Hack Wilson, you know? Like, that's the comp, because he's played some center field in his time. I mean, that's the comp for me, is Hack Wilson. And Ben laughed as much as you did when I made that comp to him. But Gurriel, you know, is a different
caliber. I've always got more like Kirby Puckett, just for body type, because that's like someone in the, you know.
I'm going cross-race with JJ.
But I'm like someone who played in the last 75 years.
Exactly. That's probably a better comp. But Gurriel is this, it prompted one debate, even in our office today, where would he rank on a top 100? And for me, he'd be a top 50 prospect easy.
Oh, I agree.
And I
but
guess
we look at him, we do look at him a different perspective.
It was a philosophical question, whereas I'm really looking at a top 100 prospect list for what that player's going to do 3 to 5 years down the line. That's how I'm looking at
or
it.
Or in the next 3 to 5 years, really.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what you're looking for.
Right. What production are you going to see in that 3 to 5 year window? I'm not looking for what they're going to do 10 to 15 years down the line.
See, and I'm looking at it. I do look at it from the perspective of, okay, an 18-year-old, a 19-year-old who could be exceptional. I'm asking it more of, I'm looking at it, yes, I'm not a GM. So I'm looking at it saying, what is he going to do in his first 6 years of the majors?
But that may come 3 to 9 years down the line. So that's why... For me, the first players I looked at on our top 100 list, without giving away where they rank, are guys like Anderson Espinoza with the Red Sox, Victor Robles of the Nationals. These are two of the younger players, less experienced, not full season time, in our top 100 list who are ranked fairly highly. For me, the next 3 to 5 years, I think I'd take Espinoza because I think he has significant upside. I don't think he'll be in the minor leagues much more than a year or two. If you believe in him, you believe that pitchers who have it don't spend time in the minor leagues. That's where I think Anderson Espinoza is.
Yeah, because again,
I think 26.
If he's as good as to go on, because I love going on Anderson Espinoza tangents, but to go on Espinoza tangent again, not covering where he is in the, he ranks in the top 100.
Yes,
shocker.
Safely,
but if he's as good as we think he is, and now again, teams are going to try to limit innings. But that being said, you get nothing. If he's as good as we think he is when he goes to low A this year, he should run out of getting there being things for him to do in low A very quickly.
Correct.
Because it's going to be like the question I've heard many a farm director say, the question they ask is, they have these different, depending on the team though, is he commanding the fastball? Those right. things. But really what it comes down to in the end is there still stuff he could learn there?
Right.
And I don't think Anderson Espinoza, Julio Urias has run the same questions. Yep. Where, no, there's not.
I think the main thing Anderson Espinoza has to prove to me in 2016 is just, can you throw 6 innings in a game? He hasn't thrown 5 yet in a game in the United States. So where we have him ranked is very bullish for a guy who's not thrown 5 innings in a game yet. But
and Julio Urias has also been on very tight.
Absolutely.
And I understand why, but it is...
It's a conundrum, and it is with Anderson Espinoza. And the days of one of the other things we've done in this issue is look back at old top hundreds. And there was one year where we did not rank any St. Louis Cardinals, JJ. And we should have because Dan Heron was the number one prospect. You know how many innings Dan Heron threw that year when he was their number one prospect?
I'm going to say 191.
193, I believe, is the correct answer. According to Bad Eddie, it was 193. Of course, I could look that up. I probably should do that.
No, it's just...
But I mean,
I don't like being only two off.
That's right. But I mean, this is a different era that we're in now. Very different era.
No one. I don't think. I don't think anyone threw 191 last year.
Oh yeah. I mean, how many big leaguers did? I mean, I know there were some, but it was probably a handful, a clutch. It's just not. Yeah. It's just, no minor leaguers probably throw more than 160. It's a 160, 170 usually is around the leaders.
193
and 2/3 innings for Danny Heron that year. And we didn't rank him in the top 100, even though he had 1.4 walks per nine. And even though I loved him in college at Pepperdine, we were just real slight on Dan Heron. But the point is that back then we didn't rank the guy almost like he was too vanilla. Now this is a guy who's so exciting, but you want to see him in 2016 pitch some innings. So that's the thing. For me, if he has a successful, healthy 2016, by the middle of 2017, he's going to be in the big leagues. So that's why he may have, over the next 3 to 5 years, as much or more major league value than a Yuleski Gurriel. Whereas a guy like a Victor Robles, who is extremely talented, but is an outfielder, ultimately, not as impactful to me. I don't see as much star potential for him in the next 3 years. He's going to need more time in the minor leagues.
Oh, yeah.
And those next
he's probably 4 years away from...
About to say 3 years from now, he could still be in the minor leagues. And... Yuleski Gurriel theoretically played all 3 of those seasons as an above-average regular in the major leagues. So for me, he has more value.
Interesting, but to delve into this point, then that would be an argument that you'd be very much on drafting college players.
No, not necessarily. It all depends on your situation as an organization.
If you draft a high school pitcher, you often are talking that that guy's not going to help us for 4 to 5 years.
Right, that's fine. If I was picking single digits, I would not be taking a high school pitcher unless he really, really stood out. This is how Clayton Kershaw fell to the 7th pick of the draft. Because there are a lot of teams that think that way. It's reasonable to think that way. And in the 2006 draft...
For every Clayton Kershaw, there are...
Right, but in the 2006 draft, there were teams that said, okay, well, we definitely think Andrew Miller is better. We definitely think Tim Lincecum is better. Maybe they didn't. We definitely think Max Scherzer could be better. We definitely think... Brad Lincoln could be better. Sometimes they were right. Sometimes they were close. I mean, Max Scherzer was close to better. I would say Tim Lincecum at his peak was as good as Pete Kershaw. His peak didn't last very long. As the guy who drafted Kershaw, Logan White, told me, hey, look, you could drive that Volkswagen cross country back and forth a few times, and it'll get you there. But wouldn't you feel more secure doing that if you had to do that in a Cadillac? And regardless of the German versus American engineering, his point was the big car, you'd rather do that in the big car than in the small car. He chose the big car, Clayton Kershaw. It worked out pretty well. That said, Tim Lincecum, 3 World Series rings, I believe. Clayton Kershaw, 0. So Giants fans are satisfied with that as well. That's quite the digression. The point is, I do think when I'm ranking a prospect list, I do think present or value close to the major leagues, we reflect it all the time. If you have success at the upper major, at the upper levels of the minors,
okay, let me ask
and you have high ceiling talent, you get ranked with the top of the top 100. That describes Yulesky Gurriel to me. So, I mean, he's clearly to the extreme end of that, but
I guess really what I'll come back to the question I'll ask, and I think we have a little bit of a difference of how we view this. When do you think the tailing off hits for Gurriel?
I don't know. I still know. I mean, I'm not as hard and fast on it as Matt Eddy in the office is, where he says, well, at 35, he's done. I don't necessarily agree with that. So
I don't agree that you're up, but it is becoming much
it
more
is.
Difficult to do it much beyond that. And if that's the case...
That's the question also, is that he has to adjust. The number one thing, I've said this on a million podcasts, the number one adjustment is the grind. Mm-hmm. And he's going to have to... This is not Eric Nietzsche's grind. This is the grind. This is 160 games. And I guess the thing is, if you're investing that much money in Yulesky Gurriel, you kind of have to have someone else to caddy for him. Because really, I don't think you probably can expect him to play, especially in his first year. If you want to get the maximum investment, you better have another third baseman so he can play 120 games. And maybe you want to have an American League team where they might value him more, because they can play maybe 100 games at third base and 40 at DH and still spread in some days off, because otherwise, I do think you'll tax him.
Especially, he's a 31, right. So he's a 32-year-old, who's also just played a half season of Serie Nacional. Now, I know that there are guys who play winter ball too.
Right.
But he's coming off of...
In that first year.
He's coming off of essentially having just played the majority of his season.
It really is. It's hard
to... And now he's got to work out... It's not like that this is going to be this siesta before he signs, because right now,
yeah, he'll be working
it
out.
Is the, okay, work out as hard as you've ever worked out. Because
he'll be on the UNS Cespedes training plan, so we'll look for the YouTube video sooner than later with Gurriel.
And again,
best shape of his life.
But the other thing about it is that we have seen, the good news for him is that we have seen a number of Cuban players who have made very, very quick adjustments to the U.S. game.
Abreu is the one who, among hitters, who just jumps out.
But Cespedes didn't also had a pretty quick adjustment.
He did, but I mean, he's also a limited player, yeah, offensively. He's a boomer bust player and doesn't draw a lot of walks. He's very, very consistent about that. I mean, honestly, Cespedes to me is more of like a 5-hole hitter. Abreu is like a 3 or 4-hole hitter. You're hoping Gurriel is closer to the Abreu model.
But what I was saying, though, is that if he does have an adjustment period, again, I would think that, again, a team who signs him for significant money this year, part of why you're doing that is that it could be a team that's not a contending in your year. But most of the teams I think of that I would think of would be teams that would be talking about this are teams who will be in contention and who that one of the selling points is again, adding available, and by free talent, I mean talent that doesn't cost you players or draft picks,
right,
who can help you right away. That's
JJ. Who's the team that makes the most sense for Yulesky Gurriel? I can tell you right off the bat, to me, the number one team that should be interested in him is the Angels. They've had a bad offseason.
Yes.
They see themselves as a contender. I know they're very right-handed. Doesn't matter. They had David Freese at third base last year. This guy would be a significant upgrade.
Hey, if we are doing this funeral pyre where we are going to eventually just head over the cliff,
correct?
Let's all head over the cliff together.
And you don't give up a first round pick, like you said. I mean, this is exactly the kind of guy.
Sure, but you know what?
And you've had
our team's going to be really heading off the cliff when Trout hits free agency anyway,
right? And you've had success with Kendrys Morales in the past. It was a long time ago, but it's the same manager. I have to imagine
he's an upgrade for them.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that he. That to me, if Billy Epler, the new general manager there, does not already know that, you've already got Yunel Escobar, another Cubano, around. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, seeing how many times Yunel Escobar is like a secret that's been passed around. Your other competition for third base apparently are just Kyle Kubica and I guess they just acquired Jeffrey Marte, who plays a little third base, and Caleb Cowart, your main man. You love Caleb Cowart.
No, but if they do have the Roberto Baldaquin aftertaste, that may dissuade.
Not on the 40-man roster.
I know, but may dissuade. That hasn't gone so well.
No, it has not. That's possible. But that would be the number one destination.
The funny one is that I don't mean this humorous, but just because the Dodgers signed all the Cuban players, I don't know where he fits for them. But
they'll think about that later. Worry about that later.
I didn't know where Hector Olivera fit with them. That didn't matter. They sign him, and then that all sorts itself out.
You're just an asset at that point. Dave Roberts, I'm sure, would figure out some way to smile about it for having him on the roster.
You know,
but I mean, to be the Angels are the best fit. I mean, you always wonder about the Nationals. Now that they need a third baseman, but they just have money to spend.
The interesting thing is that the Yankees seem like that they're very focused on. I think he would be a good fit for the Yankees, but I think that they're a team that's focused on not adding to payroll. So, kind of take them out.
Focused on the Bryce Harper future, which I think I guess Jeff Passan wrote that, and I think Jeff made a lot of good points on their offseason.
What about a team that's kind of a major big revenue team or acts like it a lot? I don't know if they have the position. No, they don't have the position fit. Their two best players play the positions he plays. I was going to say the Mariners.
Right. Well, that's it. Yeah, they have. I looked at them as well, but I thought to myself, they have $100 million committed to Kyle Seager and $200 million committed to Robbie
really,
Cano.
That's not really a good option.
And they're occupied at DH as well with NC Boomstick. I suppose they could try to play him at first base some with Adam Lynn that they just picked up.
Again, the thing
that's not the point. Like, that's not why you get him.
Again, the Red Sox don't make a whole lot of sense just because they are still kind of stuck at third base in the short term. You have to give Sandoval. Maybe again depends on when he becomes available. If they get to midseason and Pablo Sandoval has officially shown in every way possible that he's done.
Right.
Third base is one position that they're not as stacked at as they are at a lot of positions.
Suffice it to say, these are all contending teams, and to me, it doesn't make sense for a non-contending team. So there's cross out the National League.
If you're not contending, your window better start in 18. Say 17.
What about a team like the Giants, which just had, again, a very prolific spending offseason? They got an amazing year last year from Matt Duffy. Matt Duffy does have the athletic ability to move around. I mean,
well, the problem is where would you move him?
Well, Joe Panik hasn't shown he can play a full major league season yet. He's been a big leaguer for parts of 2 years and has not played a full season yet. So that's one option. I mean, you certainly could have him as this super utility player. And I just saw today that Brandon Belt hasn't signed a contract extension. So, again, first base could wind up being an option down the line.
The wild card also is that
they spent a lot of money this offseason.
Are we now just reaching the point where the Marlins have one of those rare moments where they go, we're going to spend some money. He's a Cuban.
That's a wild card as well. I mean, that could be a wild card as well. But to me,
The
Angels make so much sense. It's a perfect fit in a lot of ways to me. Yunel Escobar can play other positions. Certainly could play second base. Gurriel and he could play second or third. I would imagine that you'd... That's a team that makes a lot of sense. Lourdes Gurriel Jr., I don't know as much about JJ, but reading
offense...
We have
not been following him for the last...
For a decade.
15 years, 10,
yeah,
15
the
years.
First article that I found that I wrote about Yulesky Gurriel was from October of 2003. So, a long, long time ago. Lourdes Jr., this is a very random comment. I guarantee this is the only place on the web where you'll hear this comment made. You know what? Reading his report sounded like to me was Ryan Cordell of the Texas Rangers, a much better version. But a guy who
the good news is he plays a lot of positions. The bad news is I have no idea where he's going to play.
That's it. He plays left field for Industriales because his brother plays third base, and that's probably his best position. He's played, I think the way Ben had it broken down in one season, he played 84% of the time in left field, 16% of the time was second, short, and third. So if you sign a Lourdes Gurriel, which probably won't happen until October when he turns 23 and he's past the bonus polls,
again, why would you?
Candy bar the door.
Why? Unless, I mean, the only reason he wouldn't.
Unless Lourdes Gurriel is like the brother, like the Samuel L. Jackson character in Jungle Fever and is a little light. Yeah, he needs some money to weigh him down. Otherwise, he needs to wait till October to get the really big payday.
To explain to someone who doesn't understand, like, 23, he clears that bar, and then all of a sudden, you don't have to pay a penalty for exceeding. He becomes essentially, again, like we're talking about with his older
brother. Like a major league
free
talent.
He becomes a major league free agent, as opposed to, oh, you're going to go over to the signing bonus, which you're going to go over to sign him probably. Well, you're going to pay, again as much to MLB as a penalty, and you can only do that if you have not already.
Just the contrast was...
If you're not in the penalty box already.
Hector Oliveira, older, $62.5 million with a $28 million signing bonus. Yoan Moncada cost the same amount of money, $63 million, but $31.5 million to Moncada, $31.5 million tax. So, you know...
And by the way...
Why, if
again,
you're
the difference, and the difference there being, I think we could safely say... 30 teams out of 30 teams ago, which would you rather have? I'd rather have Yoan Moncada.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. So, so Lourdes Gurriel should
wait. Even
though
Yoan Moncada will take you 2 to 3 years before he's able to make that big league impact.
This is true as well, but I would have always had Yoan Moncada over Hector Oliveira for me, too. The way it's amazing to see Yoan Moncada and the adjustment time that he had in the South Atlantic League.
Right, but that is a useful thing to remember.
I do think Gurriel, though, let's just put it this way. Hector Oliveira was compared to the other top players in Cuba. The 2006 feature I wrote on Yulesky Gurriel compared him to Kendrys Morales, who was seen as the best player in Cuba when he was there, and Omar Linares, who was seen as the best Cuban player ever. Those were his comps. So I just think, I understand the reason we're making these comparisons to Hector Oliveira.
He's not better.
He's like 2 grades better.
Right.
Like on the
I like your Adrian Beltre that you brought up earlier today.
And the thing is, like, I think it's latter career Beltre because I don't know that he was ever the defender Beltre. Kind of a cross between a Beltre and a Longoria to me. So physically, I think he's a little bit more of a Longoria.
The rough thing to me is that, and I've always felt like I've been a little light on him in that we've seen him play at what I feel like is at his top level, rather sporadically.
Correct. In bursts.
In bursts, which makes it hard to kind of...
That's why it's crucial to defer to Ben's reports
on this.
And this is why we deferred to Ben on Hector Oliveira. Let's be honest. Last year and this year in the top 100, we've had our doubts about Hector Oliveira. Yeah. And I don't... this isn't throwing him under the bus. This is just acknowledging that Ben watches... so many Cuban games on the internet and stores them and watches them. I just imagine his Cuban baseball trove being similar to your Steelers game trove. Probably similar, don't you think?
Yes, he probably does not have a game from every year of his life.
No, I'm sure he doesn't.
Which I finally completed that. I got a 72 preseason game and now I have a game... from every year, every Steelers season of my life.
Small Super Bowl aside here, when I asked JJ if Von Miller had the best game, non-Lawrence Taylor division, of any outside linebacker, he instantly came up with, well, Jack Ham, 76. Oh, wait a minute, that was the AFC Championship game.
Yes, the AFC Championship game. The Cowboys game, he was good, but not at the same level. He had an interception 34 yards downfield.
It was insane,
34 yards in. What an athleticism.
See, you always talk about being impressed by my memory, but your Steeler memory is
the thing about
sick.
This is my wife will say, like, wait, but you know this, and you can't remember, like, you know, like you needed to get milk on the way home. And I'm like, yes. But
milk on the way home is not important.
But one of them I've been gathering in there for literally all my life since I was 2. So, you know. So if you ask me, like, every now and then, when I was watching Super Bowl X this week, because, you know, I do that, and I go, oh, wait, I forgot that number was number 41. Oh, yeah, I can't forget.
Well, Ben's comps on Yulesky Gurriel were Hanley Ramirez, when he was good, and David Wright, in terms of age and offensive performance, if he were to leave Cuba to pursue
but that
a big
gives you
contract.
An idea. I mean, we are talking about a guy.
That was last April.
And that was before. We're not talking about... David, I can barely get the ball to first base. Right. We're talking about the David Wright.
He was referencing like a peak David Wright.
Right.
But that
gives you an idea. Again, this is why we're excited about this. Can you imagine if this kind of player, which is what he is, becomes available during the season?
It'd be a frenzy. It'd be a frenzy for sure.
I mean, again, because you can look at this different ways. What happens if a team who's a contender... I mean, we're talking right now, these fits. What happens if there's a significant injury?
Right. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
I mean, we're talking about teams like, well, they're not a fit, which could be in June or May you're like, oh, that's absolutely a fit. They don't have their third baseman.
I mean, we mentioned A-Rod earlier. A-Rod wasn't a fit for the Yankees. Then Aaron Boone got hurt. Then he was a fit all of a sudden. Here's the last part of the Gurriels, because Lourdes Gurriel will be in probably more toward next year's top 100. But he does sound like a player who plays a lot of outfield, is athletic, not the offensive player his brother is, but a good offensive player, a good prospect. Number 4 on Ben's list of top Cuban players. So the last time Ben did a list, since then, 1, 3, and 4, the 2 Gurriel brothers and Jose Fernandez all gone.
This is Cuba, you know, Cuban baseball 2016.
But so, Lourdes Gurriel sounds like a very intriguing prospect, a guy who you'd like to try to sign and maybe try him in the infield as a 23-year-old. So last question, JJ, this is 2016. We have World Baseball Classic. Qualifiers are being announced currently. You had rosters come out for Australia, New Zealand, Philippines, and I forget who else is out there.
I think I know where you're going this, and I'm excited about where you're going.
So the Classic, 2006, fun. First one, fun event. People didn't quite know what to do with it, but it was interesting. We loved it. And the Asian population in Southern California with the Korea-Japan final went bonkers for it. Daisuke Matsusaka, the hero, Japan wins. 2009, unparalleled, fantastic event. Prospects out the Ying Yang Gung Ho Park, I think was number 19 that year. So it'll be like, that's like, he's like the 10th
this
guy.
I do believe Peyton Manning won his 200th game in the Super Bowl yesterday. That is our 200th reference to the World Baseball Classic 2009 right. Top 20, which we love. We love.
And we will always love. It was a great great time to be a baseball American. 2013, we were as jazz as you could possibly be. And that classic fell a little flat.
No, it was just different. What was awesome about it was awesome. And what we needed was, okay, for one, we had a different World Baseball Classic. It wasn't just, I'm sorry, but I don't get it's great that South Korea has been good at, but South Korea, this is just people catching up to the fact that South Korea plays really good baseball.
This is true.
Italy went deep. That's what the World Baseball Classic needed, though, is that...
I think that pointed out the weakness of it for a lot of people, that their best Italian players were all Italian-Americans. That's what made a lot of baseball fans not like that classic.
I go the other way, but the key thing about that, though, is that you had the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico...
That was the best story.
...playing, for one...
And the Dutch getting to the Final Four.
But for one, clearly it mattered.
It definitely mattered, especially to the Dominican players. I mean, the Puerto Rican players, it was sheer force of will of Yadier Molina to get them to the Final
right.
Four, basically.
But the Dominican Final team, two. For one, it was great to see a Dominican international team actually do something.
Correct.
Because you want to talk about punching below your weight over and over and over. In international baseball, the Dominican Republic is effectively...
And here's the... On the long story, I don't know if I've articulated this before, but... Maybe that Dominican victory in 2013. I will say, I do think it fell flat with a lot of other people. If it had more prospects, like the 2009, more guys who were going to impact the big leagues, I think it would have been a bigger deal in the United States. Maybe I'm wrong.
For it to be a big deal in the U.S., for what? At some point, the U.S. has to do something in it, too.
This is true. And
it has never happened, really, so far.
No, I mean, I guess, 2009, they made the Final Four. That's the only time they've even done that. But that Dominican team, by the fact that Dominican team won, this is one of the great fears of people in international baseball, is that with Cuba just as a country falling apart, that Cuban baseball will lose out in this, and that this great institution of Cuban baseball, the way players are brought up in the game, they are taught the game and become great baseball players, that will be lost, and that they will become basically a colony of the United States baseball-wise, the way the Dominican is. But then the DR in 2013 winning a World Baseball Classic showed that those players could come back together and win a world championship and make the entire country proud. Maybe that actually is a sign that Cuba can still be a baseball force even as it domestically becomes secondary to the major leagues.
See, here's where I thought you were going with this that I want to bring up, which is that we now have a very interesting question. Again, it's likely. You still have to say it's likely that Cuba says, there is no. The Gurriels can no longer...
Well, this is where I was headed. Oh, no, I'm headed toward... So, 2017...
But, but the thing about this is, Cuba has a choice to make. I think
they Cuba's headed toward this choice. Does Cuba want to win with a team that owns all Cubans, but Cubans who have left the
island? And by the way, and I'll say, because for one, I think that you would have... The buy-in on that would be massive.
Absolutely. No one would want... You would have to have two Cuban teams.
Right. I mean, it's going to be like... it is going to be like, wait, no. I'm playing. No, I'm playing. You know, I mean, I do think that there would be a significant, because again, you have to get out, you have to understand. I don't want to get political on this, but a lot of these players leaving, this is not what it was. This is not guys, you know, from 20 years ago where it's like, I just got to get out of here. This is, I want a payday. Everyone else is getting a payday. But I want to be able to come home, too. I mean, Cuba's my country.
And that's it. They just let Jose Contreras go back. They let all these people, Brian Pena, this U.S. Goodwill tour that was there in November. This, to me, is a sign that the next World Baseball Classic team will be Cuban expats who are in the United States.
What really gets tricky is that there are some of these players who are not even expats.
Right. I mean, like an Alexi Ramirez, whose wife is, Jamaican or Dominican.
But also, we are starting to see players who have been told, we don't understand why, but no, they have a passport that allows them to come to the States to play.
I don't know about those.
You're
allowed to go other countries. You're still allowed to make a living in the United States. You can travel, but you can't make a living. American law that keeps
it. It's American law, not all of it is, was it Jose Fernandez? One of the players from last offseason has, we don't understand how, but has a passport that allowed him. He didn't have to do that second step.
He didn't, quote-unquote, defect.
Right. But, again, the Gurriels aren't really, but they're not really defecting. I mean, this is, I want to play in the States. This is where the baseball is. And
I think I'll still use that word, though. The fact they had to sneak out.
Right.
You know.
But what I'm saying
that's
is...
That's the definition.
But let's just say, if they don't do that, if they say, no, if you've left, you can't play, that Cuban team will be... There'll still be some talent there, but it will not be a competitive...
Right. It will not be a competitive team.
It will be something that it would not be a shock if they were having to try to qualify for the next World Baseball Classic.
Again, you'd be taught. It would be like having to make a. It'd be like Venezuela or the Dominican used to be in like World Cups, or the World Port Tournament, or these kind of events where they don't have their major leaguers and they don't have their top minor leaguers. It'd be like a Cuban team now, just of players from Cuba, would basically be like, okay, this is Cuba's non-40-man roster team, and you know the United States goes in a lot of international competitions with non-40-man roster teams. And they're always competitive. No, they're always competitive. They don't win.
But they don't, I was going to say.
Premier 12. They go and they win a silver medal. And they go to the World Cups. When they won, they had Pedro Alvarez and Justin Smoke and Evan Longoria and Colby Rasmus. And guys who were big-time prospects. But when they have non-40-man roster players, they usually compete well, don't always win. So what would a Cuba team look like, JJ? I guess Brian Pena is the Cuba catcher.
It depends.
And Yasmani Grandal is really more of a, I guess, he's Cuban American.
No, but again,
do you think they would want a Cuban American?
This is where it gets interesting.
JP Arencibia, I believe, also born in Cuba, sort of a catcher.
I mean, I assume because I've got Jose Fernandez pitching Game 1 for Cuba in this.
That's a good question. I would imagine that he would be the guy. Yes, he left Cuba at age 15. So
I mean, by the way,
allegedly.
But Jose Fernandez, allegedly, he means he's not true.
Allegedly 15.
Yes.
So you're Jose Abreu, Yunel Escobar, Jose Iglesias, Jorge Soler, obviously Cespedes is on this team. Puig is probably in this outfield.
Yasmani Tomas is kicking around somewhere around here.
He's in the mix. He might have to be the third baseman with Yunel Escobar, the second baseman. I can't think of a pure Cuban second baseman. On this team. No room for Rusdy Castillo on this team. So who's your right, number but no, one?
Yoan Moncada is your second baseman.
He's an A-ball.
Yoan Moncada.
Next year he'll be close to the big leagues.
By 2017, Yoan Moncada is your second baseman.
It's only a year away.
Yoan Moncada.
I follow you, but like Alexi Ramirez wouldn't be maybe the shortstop.
And, oh, I'm saying there'd be consideration, but Yoan Moncada. If you're struggling for a second baseman, I'm giving you Yoan Moncada.
I might just take Alexi. Alexi.
I was going to say, and again, Hector Oliveira, you know, is also could theoretically.
That's right. Well, he misses that. He loses out on DH to Kendrys Morales. Or Jose Fernandez, he'll hit for himself. He doesn't need a pinch hitter.
And then your pitching staff, you're talking about Jose Fernandez. You're talking about Raisel Iglesias. You're talking about...
That's your easy top two. I think my fantasy lineup back in the day was Jose Fernandez and Carlos Rodon as your top two.
Oh, that's it, by the way, Carlos Rodon again.
He wasn't born in Cuba. He was born in Miami. But by World Baseball Classic rules, he'd be there Chris Colabello.
Yeah. But, hey, no. Chris Colabello actually... Like, born to Italian and lived in Italy, so...
Oh, he did live in Italy.
Yes.
Right.
His dad was playing in Italy, so...
I mean, the Cuban pitching, though, is a little thinner.
You're
really looking at...
Aroldis Chapman is your closer. I mean, there's no question on that.
Odris Samer, Despaigne, Roenis
Just traded
Elias,
for...
Right, to the Orioles. Yeah, Roenis Elias. These are the guys you're talking about. You'll be getting a lot of Cuban players who play pitching-wise... who play in Mexican League, who pitch in Japan, who pitch in Korea, and there are a few, but
also Yasiel Sierra, you know, some of the guys that
you could, but I don't think those guys throw enough strikes. I mean, again, this is not, the Cuban national team's not looking for Yoan Lopez.
Right.
They're looking for guys who throw strikes. To them, the guys like Yoslan Herrera, or no, who was the guy who the Nationals had?
Yunesky Maya.
Yunesky Maya, that's what they're looking for. And a Cuban national
Maya
team.
Maya probably available and says, I will...
Yunesky Maya is, he made the 59 big league innings. Let's see where he pitched last. I can almost promise you that he pitched in Mexico last year. I think I came across his stats. No, it was for the Doosan Bears in Korea. So, I mean, this is the kind of, this is why Cuba didn't stop dominating international competition. Pitching just is not the same, but the caliber of hitters is amazing.
But the one thing that is a downside for Cuban going with the U.S. players is that Cuba could dominate when it was the Cuban national team. You didn't need a whole lot of pitchers.
This is true.
Whatever game, oh, this game matters. Okay.
Jose Contreras, you're going to pitch the semifinal. Okay, a day later, you're going to pitch the final.
and Laza will come in for you.
That's
Pedro
right.
Laza will come in for you in the sixth today and the tomorrow.
That's right.
And the next day if need be.
Ooh, Yunesky Maya had an 8.17 ERA for the Doosan Bears last year.
A little tough adjustment to Korea.
Yikes. It's an offensive league in
it
Korea.
Is.
It's a very offensive league. Point being that that's the next Cuban thing I'm looking forward to the most would be if there's a Cuban expat team. That would be a pretty sick team next year, JJ.
By the
potentially
way,
sick team.
I'm just going to stop for a second to say, before I do a little ad for here, but before I do that, I just want to say, if you're still with us here at the 53-minute mark,
we're barely still here.
Of the geekiest World Baseball Classic Cuban baseball discussion that we've had, of many that we've had, many that we've had on this podcast over the years. Thank you. You are our kind of Baseball America reader and listener.
I was trying to wrap up with the whole expat team. Well, I think it's a good way to wrap up. But yes.
I also do want to remind you that, you know, we were talking about the top 100. We also have the Baseball America Prospect Handbook. It's out. If you want it, you call up. You give the number, because you're always better at giving the number.
800-845-2726.
Or go to baseballamerica.com/store. You order it. Ronnie McCabe will have his tape gun. He will ship it out to you right away.
If not him, CJ McFadder will help.
Yep.
We definitely, the sound of commerce is the tape gun for Ronnie. Taping up orders, or the label maker printing out labels. Those are good sounds for us.
You will get the full scouting reports on 900 guys. You order it from us. It's actually 930. Actually, it's 940.
950, I think, actually, with the appendix with the Latin American players.
Although we did not put Goriel in there because we just never imagined he was going to...
That's it. Ben did not think there was any way that he would go. But
that's one thing that we will have to do is like, what is Goriel's BA grade? I would say that he is probably a 55 low.
I think he's more like a 60 medium, or maybe even a 65 medium. I just think his ceiling is higher than that, even though he's that age. I would say that the age makes his risk higher, and we are talking about the adjustment to big league pitching.
I can say 60 medium.
The best players have have had that easy adjustment. I thought Hector Oliveira would be one of those players who would make an easier adjustment. I thought that he would have to probably do it at first base. Mm-hmm. But I thought, okay, he'll play first base. I just didn't know why the Dodgers were the team that signed him.
And I do think that slowed him down a little bit, partly from because like there was literally nowhere.
That's it.
They didn't. He had a hamstring problem. But also, there was no pressure to, like, let's rush him back because...
Right.
We have too many of these guys right now. I mean, he couldn't play shortstop, and that was what they needed.
One day, late night over at the winter meetings, I'll have to have Andrew Friedman take his dip out, spit it out of the cup, and then explain to me, what was the deal? When that tale can be told. I'm not sure when that'll be. Maybe it'll be Alex Anthopoulos. Maybe it'll be one of the other many GMs or ex-GMs in Los Angeles' front office. I know Alex wasn't, AA wasn't there when they made that deal, but explain to me why you guys gave Oliveira all that money and then traded him within 3 months. It's a very strange saga.
But again,
saga.
It's just money. And with the Dodgers right now, money's just money. I mean, it really is. Part of it comes down to is that talent is limited, and in the Dodgers' case, money is somewhat unlimited. So if given the choice, they really just come back to it over and over. It seems like, okay, we'll just acquire the talent. We're going to acquire the talent.
And that's what they've done. And so the handbook is out. The almanac is out. Directory went to press the other day. It's another Baseball America book you can order. And now we're working on Super Register, and then book season's over, and on to the regular season. I prefer the regular season to book season.
Prospect season also is, we'll be wrapping up soon.
Drawing to a close, really, the top 100 is pretty much the end of prospect
season.
Top 100
org talent rankings and updated top 10s. And at that point, really, when spring training starts, prospect season's over. I'm sorry. When spring training starts, that's why we try to have it. We have it all done. Because when spring training starts, we are now playing 2016. That's a different time.
I agree. And definitely an advantage of doing it the way we do it. So looking forward to having it all wrapped up. Looking forward to Friday's show. JJ, thanks for geeking out on the podcast. For JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. We'll see you Friday night at 9 o'clock Eastern time on MLB Network. And we'll see you back here at Baseball America for the next Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.